Don't be silly. You're taking the fall.
My name is Stephen Nestor, and you're listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Today we have with us Bill Fitzhugh, author of Highway 61 Resurfaced. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stephen. Glad to be here.
Highway 61 Resurfaced kicks off when Lolly Wolfhook sashays into the offices of Rockin' Investigations and says she wants to find her long-lost granddaddy, blues producer Tucker Wolfhook. Before it's over, PI slash DJ Rick Shannon has crisscrossed the sweltering Mississippi Delta in search of the thread that connects a dead man in Yazoo City found with a fork stuck in his back to an old man known as Pigfoot Morgan, who was just released from Parchment Farm after serving 50 years for murder. You've got a nice little Southern Gothic stew going on here, Bill. What was inspiration for this book?
It's hard to say. I was talking to Carl Hiaasen several books ago, and he made the point that I was crazy to try to start from scratch every time with new settings and new characters and everything, and combine that with the fact that I found myself attending all these mystery writer conventions and, you know, discovered that everybody wrote in series. So I sort of thought, well, okay, I'll give that a shot. You know, if it makes it easier to write when you've already established your main character, yeah, it makes sense. Turns out that really wasn't true for me anyway, but knowing how many, I used to work in radio, and I, you know, radio disc jockeys back in the day before deregulation used to spend their lives bouncing from station to station, market to market all over the country, and I thought that was a good device to have a recurring character end up in different places, but then I couldn't just leave him as a disc jockey because it would just, I couldn't believe that, you know, a crime would land in a disc jockey's lap in every new city. So I introduce him in the first book, Radioactivity, by having him have a sort of a midlife crisis and trying to find a way out of radio, and a crime does land in his lap there. Actually, he's brought there because someone has killed a disc jockey. He's taken that guy's place. But at the end of that story, he decides, oh, here's what I can do besides playing Led Zeppelin records. I can be a private investigator. And if I can get a radio gig wherever I am, that'll supplement my income. So combine those things, the Carl Hiaasen stuff and the mystery people and the, you know, the nomadic life of a disc jockey, and I thought, hey, I've got a series.
And which is pretty much a literary franchise, which is a good thing to have if you're a writer.
Well, it's a good thing if people embrace Rick Shannon. And it's with only the second book in the series, you know, that's yet to be proven. We'll find out. I hope so.
Well, do you keep track of sales?
Only to the extent that I, if they buy my next book, I assume that the sales of the previous book were okay. But
okay.
No, I'm not counting, and I can't even read the royalty statements they send me, and I hope nobody hears that, because then they'll really take my nickels and dimes away from me.
Well, let's just say that things seem to be working well. This is book number two, and you are published by the venerable William Morrow. But let's get back to the book. In fact, let's take a look at the book. What you've got here is we're going to call it, and I don't mean this to be disparaging, you've got a little Southern Gothic light going on here.
Yeah, actually, it occurred to me that Southern Gothic was sort of floating around in there, and I tried to punch it here and there to, you know, sort of highlight that since it is set in Mississippi.
And what you have is probably something that a lot of the book revolves around blues musicians. We're talking about the generation who could have traveled to Chicago during the great black diaspora of the 40s, and maybe did. They went up there looking for work, and they came back. What about the first guys that plugged their guitars into the wall?
Okay. Well, you know, actually, these guys, I think, except for Blind Buddy Cotton, Crippled Willie and Crazy Earl stayed around the South. They didn't get out as much. They didn't make the trip, I don't think, to Chicago and go electric. They stayed much more Delta blues and sort of, you know, the Southern circuit.
But what you have is you've really piqued the interest of people who are into the blues, because you've kind of set up a Maltese Falcon meets Muddy Waters.
Exactly.
We've got a cross between A Search for the Holy Grail, with a lot of musical references thrown in there, and some of them we can take for granted are true, but a lot of them are the product of your imagination. And the book revolves around the lost tapes made by three musicians: Blind Buddy Cotton, Crippled Willie Jefferson, and Crazy Earl Tate. And where do they get these names? We'll talk about it later. And these have become known as the legendary BCC sessions.
That's right. And depending on who's telling the story, Pigfoot Morgan might have been there.
Well, without giving too much away, Pigfoot Morgan, who I do want to say Pigfeet Markham so bad.
I know.
Or Pig Meat Markham.
Pig Meat Markham. Pig, that's right.
So I'm gonna have to watch myself. But we know that Pigfoot shows up. But you've got something that really piques the interest of people, because with the resurgence of this kind of music, and we'll say in the last 20 years, you know, you've got the Institute for Southern Culture or whatever it's called. You've got them. They've become very prominent with with keeping track of, you know, who's who in the blues world, tracking down lost tapes. They've taken, you know, the Alan Lomax one step further with documenting these roots performers. And it's become such a big business that people call up and wonder, well, you know, is there anybody out there, you know, beyond Robert Johnson? Are there any more real roots music people? You know, who are they? We want to know who they are, and you know, what secrets do they have? And you get you got me agitated in that respect.
Well, I think that's a good thing. And my timing was not perfect, of course, because Congress declared 2003 the year of the blues, and here it is 2005, and the book finally comes out. So I missed by a little bit there. And then Scorsese, whose timing is a little bit better, had out his series, the seven films by the different directors about the blues. And you're right about, you know, saying it's Maltese Falcon meets Muddy Waters. When I was writing the proposal for the book, and I was writing, you know, sort of figuring out the plot, at one point it just dawned on me, it's like, this is so derivative. It's Chinatown. It's Maltese Falcon. And then my next thought was, hey, those are pretty good things to steal from.
I know. If you're going to steal, make sure you steal from the best.
Yeah. And in addition to that, if you've got a private investigator, you can handle, you know, and somebody comes to hire him, which leads him into the crime, you've got two choices, it seems. One is they come in and they tell the truth, and that's bad storytelling.
Absolutely.
So, you know, once I got over the fact that, hey, the setup's been done before, and that's not the problem. The problem is, can you execute, you know, the rest of the story in some way that gets into the setting and the characters. And where I think I've been much stronger in plot in a lot of the earlier books, at least in some of the earlier reviews we've had, the characters seem to really pop out, especially the old blues guys.
Well, I have to disagree. I think the plot in this is very strong. You've taken a very well-worn plot, Search for the Holy Grail, you know, Maltese Falcon. Duplicitous.
Right, you got a MacGuffin. Let's go find it.
Yeah, duplicitous women, you know, people backstabbing each other all over the place, and you're able to keep this going, and you really had my interest. I do give you a lot of credit for breathing new life into what's basically a fedora fetish kind of book. You know, I don't know whether you've heard that term before,
but I like it.
But you know, it refers to, you know, like a Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler.
Okay, sure.
Kind of noir, and that's what's written. The characters are really great. The three blues musicians, aside from their names, which we'll get into later.
All right, but
you really put enough twists in here, and I don't mean to sound like a back of a book jacket, but I thought you did a really good job with this.
Well, I appreciate it. I think it was Publishers Weekly. Their comment was something about it was the fine characterization that helped overcome an overly complicated plot. I thought, it's not that complicated.
No, it isn't. No, and let me just interrupt, because you've got you do introduce a lot of characters. I've noticed when you're reading a book that follows it, this noir formula, that most of the characters have been introduced by the halfway through the book. There really are no new players, but you go beyond that and you do introduce new people, and it works pretty well. You know, I won't say too much about who they are.
Sure. So, well, you know, and one other thought that I had two questions ago was the connection between the blues and this FM rock DJ. Mm-hmm. I made the point that, and this is true for me and for Rick Shannon, because in a way I am Rick Shannon. I played Crossroads by Cream more than Robert Johnson ever possibly played it in his short lifetime.
Yeah, and I appreciate that statement. I pulled that out. I bookmarked that for discussion, and I really cracked up because Let's talk about Robert Johnson for a minute. I'm glad you brought him up. I mean, how much of a player was he in terms of the evolution of the music? I mean, there was a book that just came out. The title eludes me, and they go on. The book goes on to state that the urban blues or any kind of blues is really formed by some of the black big bands in the 20s and 30s. And Robert Johnson really was like a minor figure strumming the guitar out in the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah. I will probably be Moaning at Midnight. No, that was the Howlin' Wolf book.
Yeah.
I know the book you're talking about. And the argument made, and I can't, make an argument against it, is that Robert Johnson made his reputation almost entirely based on a little story that Son House told in the early 60s. That when they were doing an interview with him, and he tells the story of Robert Johnson going to the crossroads to sell his soul to the devil.
Or maybe I think Robert Johnson made his reputation via Eric Clapton, but that's a whole other show right there.
Right, but that story is so great because Robert Johnson dies at 27. He lived fast, died young under mysterious circumstances, so it's sort of the perfect sort of rock and roll model. What a great way to do it. And so I think that what a great idea that you can go sell your soul to the devil to learn how to play the guitar better than anyone.
Yeah,
it's a great legend. And, there's the other argument, this goes along with all of that, is that, no, this didn't evolve out of field hollers. Mm-hmm. This was dance music. It was pop music, you were saying.
Yeah, but You can hear that. You can hear that call and response in all forms of music. So I think it pretty much. You can say it did come from a rural atmosphere, from the rural blues. Because you hear that call and response in just about every form of music. Every type of African American style music, soul. Big band music in the horn sections, and even between instruments and small blues groups. So I think that statement's pretty true. It does come from what would you call them, the country blues?
Yeah, the acoustic delta blues. Yeah, I mean country blues. Sure, instead of as compared to Chicago, the electric, the jump, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I might be talking over my head, so I better get away from the music.
What's going to happen is somebody who really knows about the blues is going to be banging their head against the wall talking about, these two don't know what they're talking about.
Well, that's okay. As long as they go out and read the book and enjoy it.
But the other thing that I was talking about as the disc jockey is we played all this. I mean, the British invasion, except for a lot of the pop stuff, was a bunch of white British guys bringing this black folk music back to young white Americans.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I really appreciate that when they did it, the Animals and so on and so forth, but
yeah.
When you listen to any other European rock band from any other country besides England,
right.
If you don't have that English folk music kind of background, you are just not going to make rock and roll. I mean, you're going to...
Yeah.
Yeah, a Russian band's going to have, balakayas and all those big string instruments. Italian rock and roll is non-existent. The French, they went as far as Johnny Halliday, and I think the Germans were kind of, I don't know what they've got, but if you don't have that English folk song thing going, you just can't capture it. And is that a racial statement or what? If it is, I'm sorry, but
I don't know. Having listened to Van Morrison for so long and hear all of the references he makes to listening to the radio and going down to buy the R&B records and so forth. You certainly do hear all the English folk stuff, Irish folk stuff with Van. Absent those two influences, I don't think you're going to end up with a whole lot that rocks.
But anyway, let's get back to the book. You've got a woman named Lolly Woolrich, who we talked about in the
Lolly
beginning.
Lolly
Woolfolk, sorry. What did I call her? Woolrich? Yeah, well, it's cold and I'm wearing one of their shirts right now.
I understand.
And she sashays into Rick's office and she says, I want to meet my grandfather, and I know he's been involved with these legendary recordings of the legendary BCC sessions, and help me find my grandfather. Well, it turns out this woman really isn't Lolly Woolfolk, and that's when we're off to the races. And this is when you introduce some of the more interesting characters. We've got Clarence Pigfoot Morgan, the man who did 50 years for a crime he may or may not have committed. And you've got a couple of people here. This is where we get into the Southern Gothic thing. You've got Crail Pitts and Cuffy LaFleur. Okay? You know, Crail Pitts, just in case, I was confused myself. Crail is a guy, Cuffy's a woman.
Yes.
And they figure into the plot rather prominently, two of the most interesting people. But the most interesting guy of all really doesn't make a big appearance, and his name is Hamp Dugan. Now, I kind of call him a carpet-bagging, mulatto-passing, libertine drug dealer and racy photo-taker.
He was an entrepreneur.
He was an entrepreneur. He is as far as this book is concerned, he's the big man of mystery in this book. There are a lot of things that you intimate about him but are never really cleared up.
True.
For instance, paternity and miscegenation and, you know, who's who and what's this man's, what he really is all about. What was the inspiration for him? Because he, like I said, it's the fact that maybe he, so little is known about him, or he really doesn't make a big appearance on the pages, that I find him so intriguing.
Well, yeah, he shows up in that chapter when we return to 1953 outside of Leland, and there's so much to talk about in terms of the skin balls and the what a crazy place this little bitty town of Leland, Mississippi, used to be. But before we do any of that, if we do any of that, it's you're putting the plot together, and it has to revolve around, or you know, I guess it could revolve around any crime. I made this one a murder because I needed Pigfoot gone for a long time. And although back then you didn't have to commit murder to be sent away for a long time if you were black and you know convicted of something, whether you had done it or not. But I'd settled on this murder, and just in the course of you know, creating other characters and thinking of things that could have happened then. Once I found out about what a wild town Leland was, then it opened up all these possibilities that I probably would not have considered. And I don't want to necessarily go into them to give too much away, but I was doing my research two summers ago and met the proprietor of the Leland Blues Museum, and he also writes for the Leland Progress, which is the local newspaper there, and he gave me an article he wrote where he interviewed two local guys who were in their probably 60s and 70s, and they were talking about the gambling that used to go on there in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and people showing up in this little bitty town with suitcases full of cash. I mean, more money on the streets of Leland than in the bank, and you know, whiskey and cocaine and gambling and alcohol and prostitution and so I thought, well, if all that's going on, what other, there could be, you know, some other things going on, and so somebody has to be the purveyor of all those things.
We'll say Dugan is not the purveyor of all those things, but he's the purveyor of a lot of things.
Of many of those things. That's right. He's. And he, like you said, he has come from Chicago, or he's come from up north somewhere, and he's been passing, and you know, getting away with it and getting some people in trouble, and eventually he's the one who gets in trouble. In fact, he gets in so much trouble he ends up dead.
And we're speaking with Bill Fitzhugh, author of Highway 1 Resurfaced, a William Morrow publication. This is Poets of the Tabloid Murder. And let's get to the most, probably one of the most modern Southern Gothic characters there is in the book, and that's Crail Pitts. When I read about Crail Pitts, I immediately think to some of Harry Cruz's characters, like Jolon Mackey in A Feast of Snakes. Crail Pitts is a failed football. He was a genius at football, but an injury kept him out of the game. He thinks he has the love of Cuffy LaFleur. She's a member of a really old plantation family, and Crail is just a little bit too drugged out and a little bit too stupid to really know what's going on.
Plus he's white trash.
Plus he's white trash. Yeah, that always figures in. He's living from Tobacco Road. Where did you come up with these two characters? Because there's certain implications that have to do with Cuffy and with Dugan and miscegenation, which is I just can't get into because it'll ruin the book. It'll just ruin the surprise.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, okay, well, you're welcome. But where'd you come up with this character?
Crail, actually, there was a guy I grew up, there was a guy named down the street whose name was Crail, and I've never met another one. But I thought, all right, that's a, and he in many ways fit, you know, characteristics of Crail Pitts. He wasn't a football star, but to the back to the beginning of the story, when you've got again the Maltese Falcon Chinatown scenario where someone comes in to hire the PI, and it turns out it's not who, she's not who she says she is. So I've got this one person. Once I had figured out the rest of, you know, that there was this recording session of the blind, crippled, and crazy session, and there was reason to try to track this MacGuffin down, I wanted her to have a partner to do she didn't want to get her hands dirty because, for goodness sakes, she's, you know, from a she's the fourth generation of a cotton dynasty, and she doesn't do that sort of stuff. But she knows how to get guys to do stuff for her, and Crail is the guy who does it. He's just lovesick for this girl, and not that I ever knew any Southern girls who were manipulative or anything like that. This is fiction, after all. But, you know, I did know some nice sorority girls who went to Ole Miss.
Mm-hmm.
And they could, you'd just be amazed at what you'd find boys doing because she asked him to.
Okay, this is Family Radio, fella. You know, let's talk about Clarence Morgan. Clarence gets out of jail for murder after 50 years. And all of a sudden, people start dying. And people who know that Clarence was somehow involved in these legendary BCC sessions. And the three musicians who make up the sessions, Cotton, Jefferson, and Tate, are scared. And they're hunted down by Morgan. And I'd like to say what he does with them, because it's kind of a nice, hilarious anticlimax.
But don't say it.
But I won't say it. But it's really great. I thought it was a nice piece of poetic justice.
Well, thanks.
Okay, I can just say they're not killed, but they're put to very, very, very good use.
But there's a moment when they think they might be.
True. Okay. I don't want to take away from the suspense. How much research did you have to put in this book? You're a DJ. You've been one for many years. You were playing music in the 60s. You're pretty much steeped in the players who were influenced by the blues, and because of that, you had to go in and do some research yourself to play this music on the radio. But when it got to writing this book, you know, and you realized that you maybe had to learn a little bit more. How did you fill in the gaps in your own knowledge?
Well, with the music, I spent an awful lot of time with the All Music Guide to the Blues. And it's just like in a dictionary or encyclopedia, you'll start looking into one subject. It will link to three or four others, each of which link to three or four others. And before you know it, you're in this big pyramid, and you're going back and forth, and you've got little yellow, you know, sticky notes all over the thing, and you're reading, and you grew up hearing of all these guys' names, Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and James Cotton and so forth, B.B. King. As you back announced, you know, the Allman Brothers' One Way Out, or, you know, Van Morrison, Get Your Hand Out of My Pocket, you saw, oh, Sonny Boy Williamson wrote that. Oh, Willie Dixon wrote that. So, like you said, I had some knowledge, and I'm far more familiar with the rock covers of all this stuff than I am with the original things. I mean, I've got some of the old blues stuff, but I'm not...
I got to tell you, you know, as far as, you know, I like all kinds of music, and I like the blues, but when I hear some of these, some of the early stuff by the Chicago bluesmen, the first electric stuff.
Right.
I mean, I can't believe that, you know, like the Rolling Stones would, you know, cite this as an influence. I mean, especially after Chuck Berry came along, you know, the 2.5-minute pop song about teenage angst, you know, like,
right.
He pretty much summed it up as far as I was concerned.
I agree. I mean, I've certainly heard some of the earlier Delta guys. I mean, Charlie Patton is kind of hard to listen to. On the one hand, it's the recording technology that makes it, especially if you're, you know, if you grew up listening to music in the 60s and forward, as technology, the recording technology was, you know, vastly superior. And then to go back to, you know, Alan Lomax is out in the cotton field with a Presto disc recorder trying to, you know, get a good recording, and it's difficult to listen to and enjoy And B, it's hard to imagine, like you said, and the Rolling Stones were like blown away by this, and they had to, you know, try to do it. I sort of don't hear it. Maybe I've just not listened to all the right records.
Yeah, and or maybe you didn't smoke enough. Well, never mind.
Well, that's not the problem.
This is family radio. Now, a lot of people have read this book, and even more people will read it by the time this interview is over.
Certainly.
But what if people who are in the music business who know this music intimately, what have they said about how you presented the material, what have they said about your scholarship, and what do they say about your synthesis of situations, like the fact that there could be a BCC session and the fact that you've come up with some you know, make-believe blues musicians. What's their findings?
You know, as far as I know, no one with any degree of expertise has weighed in on it. I'm sure there will be things to complain about. But I really feel like it was very sympathetic. It's pretty accurate in terms of, you know, I was careful about, you know, technologies and musical instruments and all that kind of stuff. But I did have one guy who was a rock critic, somebody who's, you know, is a good writer about music, who really found, especially that last scene when we go back to the skin ball and the crazy night in Leland, Mississippi, that was, for him, the highlight of the book. He says, wish the whole thing had been written like that. But I don't know. I have not heard any. I should send it off to, you know, get B.B. King. Actually, a friend of mine who's an actor is sending it off to Morgan Freeman, as with the idea that he might want to, you know.
Now, there's an idea.
Get some film rights and direct. And
Well, speaking of sending your book off, I mean, where is Rick Shannon going to go next? What's the latest book going to be about? I mean, and are you working on book three in the series, or are you working on another standalone?
I'm working on another standalone right now. I'm following the Donald Westlake model of writing, where he has his Dortmunder series, but he doesn't do every single book as a Dortmunder book. He'll go off and do a standalone. So I'm working on a standalone right now.
You know, I just interviewed him last week, and he said, I'm taking a break from my Dortmunder because I've written three in a row.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because he knows he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, I met him once, and I'm a fan of. I certainly haven't read because he must have 100 books under his belt by now. But one time I was at a book festival, and I saw somebody. I was just after Pest Control was out, which was my first book, and some people were looking at it, and I sort of sidled over to hear what they had to say, and it was a guy and two women. The guy said, he's kind of a fourth-rate Donald Westlake. And I said, really, you think I'm that good? And the guy kind of slinked out of the tent, and I told the story the next year to Donald when I saw him at the festival, and I was buying one of his books, and he signed it to Bill. Aim for third rate.
Yeah. He's a funny guy.
He's great.
Okay, Bill, when your next book comes out, let us know and we'll have you back on the show.
Absolutely, but I've got to say this, that after writing Radioactivity, in which I complained loudly about the state of FM rock radio, it landed in the hands of George Taylor Morris, who's the program director for the Deep Tracks channel at XM. And I'm going to start doing a regular segment on his show where I do sets of segued rock songs the way we used to do it back on FM rock radio.
Well, so, we'll be sure to listen to that.
Yes, I think it's starting in May.
Okay, we've been speaking with Bill Fitzhugh, whose book Highway 61 resurfaced just out by William Morrow, and you've been listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder.